Who has the power to declare war, even if it's against an American citizen? Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, director of the Institute for Principled Policy. And along with me today is our vice chairman and cohort, Chuck Michaels.
And as always, I'm very glad to be here.
And we're glad to have you, as usual, because you're the one who keeps the thing running with the board. So without him, we'd have 15 minutes of dead air space. The question that we raised, or a series of questions that we raised on yesterday's program in relation to the removal of Anwar al-Awlaki from the face of the planet by unmanned drone planes in a joint effort between the chiefs of staff and the CIA, we brought up some questions because we want to look at this not from a perspective of just being a patriotic American, but from a perspective of being someone who upholds and adheres to the Constitution of these United States. That is where a source of our liberty lies, not in our feelings of patriotism, but in the black and white words of the rule of law which we live by. Now, the question for today is, who legitimately has the right to declare war upon a foreign country or upon foreign nationals? This seems to be a very, very simple thing. You say, well, you know, the president, he supposedly signed the order or checked off and okayed the order to allow them to make the hit on al-Awlaki. As a matter of fact, he had done that back in April of 2010 when it was brought to his attention. So basically, if you're looking at the news and the press, you get the distinct impression that it's the president's responsibility to declare these things. But is that what our document, our governing document, the Constitution of these United States, that our elected officials, from the president to the Congress to our judges, have to swear to uphold and obey and defend? Well, Chuck, is that, if we look now, the Article 2 gives the executive power of the president. Now, I'm not sure, and maybe you can point out to me, because you're more of our constitutional student than I am. I'm
glad you didn't say expert, because I know I'm that definitely not. I don't like that word. I'm not an expert. I'm a teacher.
Okay, a constitutional teacher. I knew you didn't like the other word. That's the reason why I stayed away from it. I mean, other than when I see that maybe in Section 2 that the president shall be commander-in-chief, and he can make treaties with advice and consent of the Senate, of course, and appoint ambassadors and appoint officers and things and fill vacancies. Maybe I've got an erroneous copy here. Maybe it's not been printed correctly. But I'm just not seeing, maybe you can point it out to me, where in Article 2, which is where the powers of the executive office of the president are vested in our Constitution, where in Article 2 it says that he has the ability to make war or to issue an order to take out an American citizen, even though that American citizen has been militantly active against this country?
Well, first of all, a little background. The reason that the president was given commander-in-chief powers is essentially because, first of all, that came down from the British sovereign. The British sovereign is always commander-in-chief of the forces, even though some of the kings were great generals and some of the kings were really lousy generals. But the sovereign always has the final power to control the army by historical precedent. Now, that being said, the real reason that the president has commander-in-chief powers is, let's say it's 1787 and the United States of America is invaded, which was not an unfamiliar thing.
I was going to say, that's not necessarily out of the realm of possibility.
It's completely not out of the question. Now, let's say they invade somewhere near Washington, D.C. Again, War of 1812, we can think that actually happened.
Mm-hmm.
So, what do we have? We have a situation where, in 1787, you couldn't notify the states quick enough to call up the various militias into federal service, sometimes it would take months. It would take 6 weeks to get a letter to Georgia to tell them that war had been declared. So the reason that the president was commander-in-chief so he could use the standing army to defend the United States until such time as a war could be declared and a true military response could be mounted.
Well, wait a minute. Isn't just the president by his own action of taking the role of commander-in-chief and directing our troops and putting them in those situations where they're actually engaging an enemy, doesn't that by default create a declaration of war?
Well, if you ask the anyone who's been in the executive department since about 1898, perhaps, maybe 1914, that's arguable. But the idea is that because the president has commander-in-chief powers, all of a sudden he also can decide where and when to use the army whenever he feels like. Well, that is exactly what the founding fathers were doing their best to avoid. They did not want the president to have unilateral military power to send the army wherever he wanted to, basically to convert the republic into an empire. So, you're not going to find that stuff in Article 2. Where you're going to find it...
Okay, yes. I'm glad to hear that because I thought maybe I had a defective copy of the U.S. Constitution sitting here looking at.
You do not.
Because I didn't see it in Article 2 anywhere. I mean, I see the commander-in-chief thing, you're right, and I see that, you know, he is commander also of the militia of the states when called into the service of the United States. Now, it never says in here that he's making that call. Who's making that call?
Well, if you look very closely at Article 1.
Oh, Article 1. Wait a minute. That's where our lawmakers are situated at. The Article 1 is the legislative. Yeah, see, hey, right here, Article 1, Section 1. All legislative powers herein granted shall be vested in the Congress of the United States, which will consist of a Senate and a House of Representatives. What does that have to do with war making?
Well, it's amazing that the founders were very wise in putting the power to make war in the hands of the representatives of both the people in the House of Representatives and the states in the Senate. Now, isn't it interesting, not to get too far into this, but the states have lost their representation in Congress in the form of the Senate to what is now basically a super legislator in the form of a senator who's a congressman for 6 years instead of two.
Well, maybe we should talk about that at a later episode, but I'm flipping through here. Article 1, it's a big Article 1 of the Constitution's got a lot in it. I mean, Section 1, Section 2, Section 3, Section 4, talking about times, places, and manners, judging their own elections, setting up a House and a Senate, money, paying them money for doing their jobs. Well, hopefully they are doing their jobs and earning the money that we are paying them.
That's right.
But I guess then, where do I find where their job descriptions are? Because it tells me how to pay them, tells me when to set them up, when they get to start to work. Where do I find what work they're supposed to do?
Well, if you want to see what their job is specifically, you'll have to look in Article 1, Section 8.
Oh, okay. Article 1, Section 8. Oh, here it is. Okay. The Congress shall have power. Oh, that's good. I like that. Power. To lay and collect taxes, duties. Wait a minute. They can tax? Oh, well, we'll talk about that in another program.
Another show.
Debts, duties, borrow money, regulate commerce, naturalization, bankruptcies, coin. This all seems to be economic.
Well, keep going.
Okay, counterfeiting. Oh, punishment. Oh, there's. Oh, maybe that's part of it. Punishment of counterfeiting securities and coin. No?
No, I don't think Alaki was counter. He may have been counterfeiting, but that's not what he got in trouble for.
Okay. Promote progress of science. Constitute tribunals inferior to the Supreme Court. Oh, they're talking about our district courts. I understand that. Here. Define and punish. There's that word again. So if I look at punish, that's probably going to help me out here a little bit. To define and punish piracies and felonies committed on the high seas. Was he on a ship? I thought he was sitting in the mountains somewhere in Yemen. And offenses against the law of nations. Ooh, that seems like an important concept.
Now, yes, it's a very important concept.
It's even capitalized here in the Constitution.
That's right.
Capital L, law, capital N, nations.
Anytime you see something capitalized in the Constitution, it means that the founders found it important enough that they wanted it to stand out.
Okay. All right. Oh, here it is. Here it is. Article 1, Section 8. About halfway through it, it says, Congress shall have the Congress shall have power to declare war. There it is. So our lawmakers are the ones who have to decide whether or not we're going to end up fighting, expending resources, personnel, materiel, firing bullets, rockets, etc., running tanks, jeeps, helicopters, fighter planes, unmanned drones, whatever it be, against an enemy. It's our Congress that has to do that, right?
That's right.
Okay. Hey, Chuck, as our constitutional teacher, can you help me with this next little thing? Because I'm not really sure what this means. It's under the same section, under the same subheading. It says, to declare war, comma, grant letters of marque and reprisal. What's a letter of marque and reprisal?
That's a great question. And if you refer back to that earlier section that you talked about, the Law of Nations.
Okay, yes.
That gives us a little clue of where we need to go to get a little insight into what is meant by the Law of Nations and a letter of marque and reprisal. Now, okay. It turns out that if we do a little research, the Founding Fathers relied on people, certain writers and thinkers, for insight into things like international law.
Sure, we've talked about that on a previous program. I think that they took most of the concepts from the Bible, and we know the Bible is a book that talks about war quite a bit. But I'm not sure I've necessarily seen Law of Nations, even though we know that that's based in God's Word. Where does this Law of Nations concept come from?
Well, you're going to have to look at a writer named Emmerich de Vittel.
Okay.
And he was a Swiss, and he was quite well known during the founding period as the go-to guy for international law. And he wrote a book basically called The Law of Nations. And there's a much longer 18th century type title. So by the time you end up reading the end of the title, you basically know almost everything that the book says.
Okay. So in other words, it's not a title we want to go into now because
not
we did take a whole, an entire program to read the
believe
title.
Believe me, you can find it under the name The Law of Nations.
Okay. Very good.
And
okay.
Vittel, V-A-T-T-E-L.
Okay. So what does Vittel's book, The Law of Nations, have to do with our Constitution?
Well, basically, they used him as the reference source for writing things having to do with international relations.
Really?
Yes.
Okay. Well, what did they say? Is that where this letter of marque and reprisal idea comes
that
from?
That is where the letter of marque. Now, the letter of marque and reprisal was already under use by nations. What Vittel did was basically take the concept that was already in use and standardized it. He codified it and put it into writing and basically laid out the rules that had come to be used to issue letters of marque and reprisal.
Okay. I'm still not quite getting it. Can you boil it down for me? What does a letter of marque and reprisal do?
A letter of marque and reprisal is something that a legislature puts out that allows persons, either the military or private, what they call used to call privateers, from recovering the costs or punishing things having to do with nations who harbored criminals and allowed acts that harmed nations or citizens of nations. Such as
Anwar al-Awlaki's getting the underwear bomber and trying to get him on a plane, and the guy in Detroit and putting bombs inside printers and trying to ship them into the United States to create havoc?
Oh, that's correct.
Okay. And
now, that of course, the founders didn't know anything about planes or underwear bombs or anything like that, but they were dealing with similar things with things like the Barbary pirates.
Okay.
Piracies on the high seas. And as you'll note, that piracy is one of the things that is covered under this. It's in a different paragraph, but it's covered under the same kind of thing.
Okay. Well, Chuck, I that helps a little bit. So basically, we're saying now that Congress, our legislature, our national legislature, is the only one who has the power to declare war against a country. But they're also the only ones who have the power vested by the people in this document to grant these letters of marque and reprisal, which is basically a letter that says, please go ahead and take care of taking vengeance upon this person or that person.
And that's correct. Now, here's the unfortunate part. We're out of time for today.
Okay.
Well, so we're going to have to stretch this into tomorrow. So I would say join us tomorrow, and we will see if we can't wrap up the discussion on international law and the issuance of letters of mark and reprisal.
Well, then, well, I guess we'll have to see exactly if Congress does issue one of these, what do we do with it?
Yeah. Tune in tomorrow at 5:30 to find out the rest.